This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand, and of course welcome to our regular listeners around the globe. I'm Henry in Sydney, where it's been pouring rain since Christmas. Don't get me started! I'm now joined by two of our North America correspondents. Thomas Booker is in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas.
Yeah.
And Roland Seagrave is in Edmonton, Alberta in Canada. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Henry. Good evening, Thomas.
Glad to be back. Glad to be with you all.
I got to say, you know, Ronan, two of our correspondents here in Australia have moved city and they keep moving around the place. They're like nomadic and I can't keep up. And now you're in Alberta and not Winnipeg. What's going on?
No, I'm in Alberta and in Edmonton 4 to 5 days a week with a new role here with the government. So it's keeping me really, really busy. And yes, I'm currently billeted at the Matrix Hotel in downtown Edmonton until maybe I sort something a bit more permanent out, but I fly back to Winnipeg Thursday evening.
Is it a nice town, Edmonton?
Well, it's a government town. I mean, its nickname in Canada,
it's like Canberra.
It's Deadmonton. You know, that's just
like Canberra in Australia, which is of course the capital city. And hello to our listeners on Valley FM 89.5, which broadcasts into that capital city of Canberra. So you'll be going back home soon. Look, there's a lot to talk about. I want to actually start with Elon Musk, who has now bought Twitter for more than $40 billion. A lot of people keep saying that Elon Musk can't do these things, but he keeps doing them, guys.
Well, when you're a mega billionaire, giga billionaire, you can do whatever you want to. I mean, the guy is he's unhinged, unchained.
He can do it. I mean, there is talk of putting this to some kind of regulatory review, but I don't really see it stopping this deal. I think the view is that Elon Musk, having been a sort of previous supporter of Donald Trump, is likely to welcome him back to Twitter, and it's likely to be a more safe territory for sort of hard right folk. And who have sort of abandoned it, and some of whom obviously have had their accounts permanently closed, but have abandoned it for other platforms that have really gone anywhere. So there's a sort of view that the Don will soon be back on Twitter.
Yeah, but the Don has said that he doesn't want to be back on Twitter.
Don't believe a word of that.
I know, of course you don't. but it's interesting because he has his own platform, which is completely unsuccessful, but he says, "Oh, I don't need to go on Twitter anymore because I got my." I can't even remember what the name of his platform is.
It was a Truth and BD Network or some kind of not
something. Really... The word Truth was in it, which I thought was really ironic.
I stopped there.
Elon Musk is promising great things for Twitter. He's talking about more freedom, and I think code will be outsourced or free or something. I don't really understand the technology behind that. We have to wonder what his plans are for Twitter and if it will improve the service. There's talk about people being allowed to edit what they post, which is something that millions of people have been asking to do because they post something and go, oh, shit, I didn't want that. Yeah. So they want to edit it.
I think I should add, because I'm a citizen of Texas, alas, that a lot of this was motivated by, first of all, California is basically, Musk got infuriated with California, number one, because they put COVID restrictions on his Tesla factory. And he also was having to deal with all the regulatory processes and also other issues that were cropping up. And he didn't want to be regulated in California. So he has taken his entire Tesla plant and relocated it to Texas. He has it in Austin now. He actually has a huge chunk of Travis County in Texas dedicated to his new Tesla plant. And that's his first goal of freedom. And then his second one is he's got his rocket facility out on the tip of Texas, southern tip of Texas in the Gulf of Mexico. Once again, he's battling federal regulators, but he set all that stuff up there because he didn't want to have to mess with Florida, where he would be under scrutiny by NASA and other agencies. So that's our contribution. Now we can go ahead and talk about what the Twitter catastrophe is going to
be. It's interesting because, Thomas, I know you're a science type, and I also know that think that you don't really like this guy, Elon Musk, very much.
Well, for one thing, he's not that brilliant. He's not that much of a genius. He hires geniuses. I mean, his engineering that he's done on recoverable boosters and some of his vehicle designs are really astounding, but it's not him. It's his money. And he just apparently knows how to go out and cultivate the expertise that he needs to achieve his aspirations. But as is constantly pointed out on Facebook and elsewhere, the guy was raised in South Africa.
He's from Pretoria, parents, I think, yeah.
At Pretoria, he was. His parents were very much pro-apartheid. He has a smug superiority about him, and I really don't think his fealties lie with anything of progressive thought.
Is he an Afrikaan?
He's a baby. Ex-Afrikaan in terms of no longer lives, but he still carries South Africa in his heart. So just that other aspect too. But that's South Africa, not Texas. So I'll shut up about that.
Yes. Okay. Now it's interesting. I asked our correspondents the first apps they open when they wake up in the morning here in Australia, and Adam, our Australian political correspondent, said Twitter, and you know what? I don't use Twitter. Am I the only person in the world who doesn't? Ronan, do you use Twitter?
I have to admit, rarely. I mean, I do have a couple of accounts, but I rarely use it. I did use it a bit in sort of the early days, and then I thought it just became a really kind of toxic place in terms of, you know, trolls and now obviously bots that Elon Musk is also saying that he's going to get rid of.
That's right, yeah.
And I just found it kind of just really kind of nasty edge to it, and really just didn't associate myself with it. I mean, I think, you know, we'll find out in due course what Musk's plans are for it. I do remember he did recently, a few months back, host an episode of Saturday Night Live.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, he kind of talked about having Asperger's and how that sort of influences his sort of behavior and style. He has an unconventional personal life. You know, he has 7 children.
What? I did not know this. Yes,
most recently with the singer Grimes, who he has a sort of on-off relationship with. She actually appeared on the Saturday Night Live episode. And it was, I think, an attempt by him. There was quite a lot of controversy around the fact that he was hosting it. But, you know, Donald Trump's hosted it in the past. Why not him? I think he was trying to project a sort of kindler, gentler Elon Musk. I mean, I agree with Thomas. I think he clearly hires brilliant people. Mm-hmm. Where I probably differ from Thomas is I do think the man has vision. I think Steve Jobs' famous line was hire people smarter than yourself, but Steve Jobs had a very clear vision around what he wanted to do. And I think Elon Musk has a very clear vision around his businesses in terms of space and electric vehicles, in terms of exactly what he's trying to do. So I think people like that are fascinating in some respect. I think the issue here is a simple one, is whether social media platforms that are used by millions, if not billions, of people around the world should just remain in the hands, should be a rich man's plaything and be allowed to sort of shape and do what they want with it. The counter argument to that is, well, you're talking about regulation and that sort of going against the kind of sort of free speech element of it. So I suspect Musk would be allowed to take it over. I think we'll have to just wait and see around how Twitter develops. There are already various sort of left-wing, I guess, leaning celebrities sort of indignant about the whole thing and leaving en masse. It might take on a more right-wing kind of hue about it over the coming weeks and months.
Yeah. I think it's a done deal, quite frankly. I honestly do.
I absolutely. Yeah.
Look, if you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes in Sydney, Australia, and I've got Thomas Booker in America and Ronan Seagrave in Canada on the line. I want to switch now to stuff that's going on in Canada. Pierre Poilievre, which I can't pronounce properly.
great job. Yep.
Thank you. I did a bit of French in school. His support for Trucker Convoy disqualifies him from political leadership, says someone called Jean Claris. Now, are they calling him the Trump of Canada, or what's going on with this story?
He's sort of, you know, getting into that kind of analogy territory. He's, you know, he controversially, I mean, Pierre Poilievre is a candidate for the leadership of the Conservative Party in Canada. Yes, it's having yet another leadership election after its previous leader, Éireann O'Toole, failed to defeat Justin Trudeau in the last federal election last September. So they're having yet another leadership election. Mm. Pierre Poilievre is seen as the front runner, and he's been holding, I think, what could be described as sort of quasi-Trump-like rallies, where he's been shouting about freedom and how he supported the truckers' convoy, and he's against, you know, unscientific vaccine mandates, which doesn't really make any sense. And he at the moment, I mean, this campaign won't conclude until September, but at the moment he appears to be the front runner. Jean Charest, who is the other leading candidate, is the former premier of Quebec, and he's taking a much more kind of centrist position in terms of the leadership race, you know, saying that, you know, Poilievre is at the extremes, the Canadian electorate is not at an extreme, and that electing Poilievre will just simply hand yet another election victory in 4 years to the Liberals. So it's, but what's really interesting about this campaign, Henry, is it's much more nastier than I think previous campaigns. These are candidates really having a right go at each other, and I think Poilievre has helped to create that frisson by his outspoken sort of embrace of populism, as I say, embracing truckers and freedom convoys and opposing, at this point, almost any kind of restrictions that were brought in respect of the COVID-19 pandemic.
I just want to mention, you know, the world is trending to the right, it seems to me. Now, you know, God help us, France nearly fell into this trap. Mm-hmm. As our listeners will know, there was a federal election in France, or I should say a national election. Macron, for the first time in 20 years, is a president who got a second term, and he beat Le Pen. She conceded. He won by a good, decent amount. But, you know, a lot of people were holding their breath as this election came along, guys.
Yeah, no, yes. It was concerning. I think that a couple of things that are notable about the election. The one was that the sort of almost total collapse of the traditional sort of centre-right, centre-left parties in France that have been there for many years and indeed decades. They polled abysmally in the first round of the presidential elections. And it was the more populist and hard-left and hard-right candidates who did quite well. A guy called Michelon, who is on sort of the hard left, polled around sort of 24-25%. He urged his supporters, holding their nose, but to vote for Macron, that they couldn't in all conscience vote for Le Pen. And similarly, there was another, I can't remember the guy's name, there was another even more extreme sort of right-wing candidate who also did quite well. I think it has to be said, Emmanuel Macron has A, genuine charisma, and B, is actually quite a brilliant politician. Mm-hmm. You know, he's created his own political party. As you say, Henry, he's now the first French president in 20 years to be re-elected. So kudos to him. I think what is concerning here, though, is that there was no obvious successor to him in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. There's just nobody there that you would say, yeah, that's the person who's going to succeed Macron. Le Pen has said that she won't run again. I mean, I think this is her third go, but she'll only be sort of 58. By the time the next one comes around, so not that old. Mm. All that said, Macron's record is not that bad in terms of the challenges that he's faced. He remains a really critical conduit to Putin in relation to the Ukraine situation. He, of course, offers, you know, stability in terms of European leadership. But I think the challenges are that the second term really has to work and resolve some of the sort of social unrest and issues within France. To avoid, you know, without someone with Macron's charisma and political skills, Le Pen potentially winning next time out.
It is a bit scary, Thomas, do you think, from an American's perspective? It is kind of scary that Le Pen got that far.
Well, living in a state who has a looming fascist a political force
yeah,
of its,
it's
own.
True. It is true to say that France is like that, isn't it, these days?
And but that's the thing I don't understand. You know, it might be a little other topic to get into later, but what is the gripe in Canada that they have a right wing, and what is the gripe in France? Is it mainly in France that they're griping about the fear of being overrun by immigrants
Muslims.
Or something?
Immigration has been a big driver, Thomas, particularly. You know, France's colonial history in mm-hmm. North African countries has led to very large-scale immigration from those mainly Islamic countries. And you know, people like Le Pen have exploited that. They've exploited fears and stoked, essentially, the fires of racism. And there always has been that streak in France around sort of purity mm-hmm. and what it really means to be French. Also, when you look at it, though, some of these issues that people are also getting fired up are issues that are non-issues in countries like Canada. You know, raising the retirement age to 65, well, it already is in Canada. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The kind of issues that don't seem, from a North American perspective, to be that kind of severe or important.
Yeah, Canada has a huge social safety network, and they seem to be thriving economically, and they seem to have a vastly more intelligent populace than the United States.
Ooh, did you really say that?
I'm sorry, I can tell you what's going on now politically, and then you can find out for yourself.
Yeah, okay.
I just don't understand why they have a segment of the population in Canada that has a gripe.
We'll be right back.
Broadcasting on 13 stations around the world. Wherever you are never far away. This is the Bondi Tunes Radio Network.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with our correspondents, Thomas Booker in America and Ronan Seagrave in Canada. Thomas, now, our other North America correspondent, Dawn Dross, is not available to talk to us today, but this is a story coming out of Florida, which is quite alarming. Now, the governor of Florida is a man called Ron DeSantis, and on Friday he signed a bill that strips Walt Disney Corporation of self-governing authority at its Orlando, which is where our correspondent is, area parks, in retaliation for its opposition to a new law that limits the teaching of the LGBTQI plus issues in schools. Just fill us in on this.
Well, before it's a Florida and Texas story.
Oh, I see.
So
okay.
In that regard, I'm going to have to here to talk about it.
Oh, can I have one?
Sure, Henry, there you go. Hand it over to you.
So, thank you so much.
Yes, basically, it's this absurd thing going on now that partly is the textbook wars. They've been escalating in the textbook wars and in the invented threat from liberals as they perceive them. And one of the areas of threat is, first of all, the gay and lesbian community. And I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that Disney World in Florida has prudently decided to back the gay and lesbian community, because they're a huge source of it's not only its staff and employees and talent in the corporation all over the place. I mean, in California and in Florida, but they also they have a huge customer base and visitors. And as a matter of fact, they were the place that even set aside a gay lesbian day. Because of they would honor and give privileges to that community whenever they wanted to come in and have a day at Disney World. And what's happening is there is this far right wing backlash, and it's basically they have a straw man to grab onto and horrify and terrify everybody. And of course, it's Northern Florida where all these problems are cropping up. Mm-hmm. And it has gotten to the point of absurdity. And so Texas, likewise, is having this backlash against historical revisionism. And also they're picking up on this basically vaguely hidden racist theme that they're working politically, Florida and Texas, and also against the gay and lesbian communities. So in Florida's case, they started having this big movement about don't say gay in Florida. They're actually trying to repress references and repress any kind of integrity to the GLBT movement and in general the horrific lesbians who are undermining our nation, gays and lesbians and all of that. So they have this straw man that they're pushing on. And then they also, they've adopted, in Texas, likewise, it's this back and forth. Our governor that was why he tried to close the border, because he was afraid of immigrants. And it was mainly not just Mexican citizens and South American citizens, but all kinds of, Muslims and others. And he was claiming they were hitching rides on 18-wheelers. So he's the one who started the border inspection, the secondary border inspection that completely wrecked the whole supply line industry from Mexico to the United States. It's all across the nation. So that was a catastrophe and a farce there. And he's also been deploying National Guard troops on a totally useless mission of patrolling up and down the Rio Grande looking for waves of immigrants that aren't there. And they became very demoralized. And then just recently, one of their members, a National Guardsman, was drowned in the Rio Grande River trying to save immigrants trying to cross. And he got washed down the river and drowned, and that's done more. In the meantime, in Florida, DeSantis has been escalating this war. And so now this thing that they're doing is they're going through school books and textbooks in Florida, and they're looking for any evidence of revisionism, historical revisionism, and any evidence of what they're now, the buzzword that they're now using is critical race theory. And they're also looking for any kind of historic revisionism and that demeans or puts any kind of critical view towards American history, the history of the United States.
You know what? Sorry to interrupt you, Thomas. The minute you said about the books, I just immediately got a flash to images of books being burned by the Germans in the Second World War.
Yes, it's been compared very much. The absurdity of it is not just they're trying to purge libraries of books that have socially progressive references. So they're trying to purge school libraries of any books that might have any content that refers to any sort of sexuality. And they're trying to get rid of, they're trying to ban To Kill a Mockingbird because it's too disturbing.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yes. Oh, other books like that. Fahrenheit 451. Matter of fact, Fahrenheit 451, oddly enough, has been burned on pyres. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the things that DeSantis is doing. But now he's also going into the textbooks in the schools. And he's now going after math books because he's finding story problems in math books that are making I'm not kidding. This is serious.
He really has more other pressing matters to deal with.
No, his whole state's going to shit. The other thing that he's doing, I didn't mean to use the
S word, yeah.
Scatological reference, but the other thing is that the major employer of the state of Florida doesn't really have, other than NASA, doesn't really have that much industry to it. It doesn't even have much agriculture. Mm. And Disney is hugely powerful in that regard because it's the major, about it's like 30% of the population of Disney is employed one way or the other at Disney World.
Thomas, I'm a bit confused by all this. Disney is a corporation. It's an entertainment organization. Mm-hmm. Why is it involved? You just mentioned the amount of employees they've got in places like Florida. But I just find it really interesting. I'm a bit confused as to why they're so involved, embroiled in this kind of stuff.
Well, because they're refusing to abide by what DeSantis
did. Oh, I see.
They're brushing away his criticisms and thumbing their nose at him. Just basically... And, this is the irony of it all, that Disney originally wanted to establish Disney World because he was getting tired of California, because California, first of all, he had a bad reputation in California because he helped the blacklist during the 50s, and he tried to turn in some of his animators who tried to unionize Disney and all of this. He was this ultra-conservative, very right-wing.
Is that right?
That's true. That's another story in itself.
Yeah. Sorry, I just want to ask Ronan, what do you think of all this from a Canadian perspective? Are the Canadians looking at this going, they're all gone mad?
Pretty much. I mean, this type of thing, just unheard of in Canada, it just would not happen. In fact, the opposite in terms of, a movement here more to look at Canadian history much more critically, particularly in relation to things like the First Nations. Reconciliation in that regard. So people look at this stuff in the United States and think just people have gone start raving mad. Mm-hmm. There's no issues in Canada around teaching critical race theory. There's no issues here in relation to sexuality. And I would certainly very strongly argue that it's a far healthier society for that regard. Mm-hmm. I find this sort of targeting of communities and people who have suffered so much prejudice, hate, and discrimination in the past, which really were very disturbing. And these are not matters in which, in my view, perhaps it's a naive one, that politicians should be in any way getting involved in, other than ensuring that there are laws that everyone is an equal member of society, and that their sexuality, gender, or race, or anything else is completely irrelevant. And I think that's the kind of society that Canada is trying to create. It's not perfect. We have our failings, but there is no politician in Canada, unless there is one I haven't heard of, on such tiny support, in any way advocating anything like this. In fact, it's the complete opposite.
I wonder, Ronan, you and I are from Ireland. I live in Australia, a Commonwealth country. You live in Canada, a Commonwealth country. Apart from the really bad history of the British Empire, do you think it makes a big difference, the fact that we have... Because Canada and Australia have a lot in common. We're roughly the same size. We're Commonwealth countries, and we have a lot of the same values. And I'm just wondering if it's because we're Commonwealth countries. Do you think that makes a difference?
Yes, actually, I think it does. I think that Canada, its status as a kind of a liberal sort of progressive democracy that is a bit different in terms of its social structure and constructs, that is very much an incredibly secular and tolerant society. I mean, there's no, you know, politicians the other side across the border, you're constantly invoking God and all that kind of stuff. It just doesn't happen here at all. Mm-hmm. You know, many of our leading politicians are frankly atheists, and no one really cares. So I think in terms of their cultural and social construct, I think that they see themselves as liberal, modern democracies, trying to create societies that are more equitable, that are more equal, that discrimination, and there is systemic racism in Canada, as there is in Australia around First Nations and Aboriginal.
Yes.
But actually acknowledging that this is a reality and trying to do something about it, I think, is a feature of both countries, imperfect as that is. And I think we do look at Canadians, look at what's going on in the United States with a mixture of, at times, just total bewilderment, at times actually with some genuine fear.
Thomas, how do you feel about that?
No, they should be, because they do have a right-wing element encroaching on them, and that all of us. There was an article in the New York Times this last Sunday about the guy. There's a guy. He lives in Oregon, and he basically has. He's kind of like InfoWars, but he's more cleaned up, sophisticated fascist.
That sounds like an oxymoron to me.
Well, he's basically the guy. They did the profile of him. He's the guy who's invented all of these issues, the critical race theory and the homosexuality, all the buzzwords that you're hearing bantered about. And he basically, first of all, critical race theory is a totally bogus argument. It's a phony, fake. There's no critical race theory being taught in grade schools or anything. It's basically a legal document. It's a big, thick compendium of legislation and ordinances and codes that have been embedded in the legal network of the United States that basically have supported a racist agenda, basically segregation and separation. And it's not the only place it's going to be taught. It's a reference book for graduate level law students. It's a reference resource for graduate level law students. It is not taught in any of these schools. It's not in any textbooks. It's not in any, you know, jingles or anything like that. It's a complete, utter, and total lie. And this guy has been the one who's been pushing it. He gets on. Oh, he's on OAN. I don't know if it's OAN. I know he's a big handy feature on Fox News on that. Now I've gone blank on that major idiot that got posting on Fox News. But he basically has generated, he's found ways to generate all of this, the non-issues, and play them. And that's what's being played right now. That's basically what's driving all the right-wing politics. Mm. And none of the news agencies or news organizations are picking up on this and pointing this out. And none of the political organizations, which I bashed my head against the wall, have sense enough to go look at this stuff and come out and say, hey, folks, this is all a lie, and be able to stand up on their campaigns and their speeches and say, this is a lie. Time can never mend the careless whispers of a good friend to the heart and mind. Ignorance is kind, but there's no comfort in the truth. Pain is the hole you find. Should've known better, we'll be right back.
Vous écoutez Bandai Jules depuis Sydney en Australie et partout dans le monde. Le soleil ne se couche jamais sur Bandai Jules. Bandai Jules, playing
all over the planet now. If you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand, and also our listeners around the globe.
And Twitter won't be helping either, yes.
Probably not. I want to quickly talk about the Queen. I know we've got to go soon. I want to talk about the Queen who turned 96, and we were just talking about Commonwealth countries, Ronan. It's interesting to see...
Sorry.
It's interesting to see that it seems like the Americans are, if not equally obsessed with British royalty, maybe more obsessed. Now, Ronan, you and I are from Ireland. Mm-hmm. We live in Commonwealth countries. Is royalty important anymore?
I think Canada, that there's a sort of mixed view in it. There isn't a massive... I would say political movement in Canada, you know, for a republic and sort of removing the Queen as head of state. That, you know, there is obviously a small movement around that, but it's not mainstream. Hmm. And I do know people in Canada who are absolute royalists. You know, that they believe that the royal family and the Queen and should remain the head of state in Canada. And we have sort of supporting political apparatus around, you know, the Governor General. Appointed, you know, nominated by the Prime Minister, ultimately appointed by the Queen as a representative, as a sort of quasi head of state type figure.
Same in Australia, of course. We've got our Governor General.
I think where things were, you know, could be different is, and it seems getting nearer, when the Queen does die, and that's going to happen sooner rather than later. Mm. And, you know, Prince Charles...
who's been waiting a long time.
He's been in his 70s now, but he's been waiting a long time, you know, takes the throne. He's a very different type of person. Mm. You know, the Queen has obviously earned huge respect, even from people who are not fans of the royal family, just for her devotion to public service. And she's been doing this for, you know, over 70 years. And all of the trials and tribulations, some of which obviously self-inflicted. But I think there's a lot of respect for her. I think Prince Charles is a very different type of figure. I mean, in some respects, he comes across as maybe a bit odd and a bit eccentric. Mm. There's obviously the whole history around Princess Diana, the marriage, the divorce, and her ultimate tragic death. Mm. He did get a win recently where the Queen confirmed, and she's having to sort of tidy all this stuff up now.
Yeah,
confirmed that, you know, when Charles is crowned king, Camilla will be crowned queen, and it will be a sort of a queen consort partner for, and that kind of, I think, was greeted with less shock than it might have been sort of 20, 30 years ago.
You're damn afternoon. Right. 20, 30 years ago, that would have been a big problem.
Been accepted. I mean, the ongoing sagas that again, are the big issues and problems that the royal family are dealing with is, number one, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, with Prince Harry having sort of left the family up sticks and now living in Santa Barbara in Canada. We had the famous interview with Oprah Winfrey, with all sorts of allegations being made around Meghan Markle was being treated. Some as yet unnamed member of the royal family making remarks about, at that time, their unborn son and whether it would be black or not. So yes. We do know that a book's coming out, Henry, later this year, from Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, which promises, you know, we will be, you know, quite more shocking revelations is kind of the mood music. Prince Harry made a big fuss that he was briefly in England on his way to opening the Invictus Games in Holland, that he met the Queen and he wanted to protect her from other people, and people were saying, well, who are you protecting her from? And I think the other issue is, of course, Prince Andrew.
I was about to mention Prince Andrew, the Duke of York.
Made a recent public appearance at his father, Prince Philip's, remembrance service, which was long delayed due to COVID. Mm. And he was the person escorting the now very frail Queen to her seat. And apparently this absolutely enraged Prince Charles and Prince William, who want Andrew banished into outer darkness.
Outer space.
Andrew is living in some kind of fantasy world that he thinks he can make some kind of comeback here. There's no way the British public are going to tolerate that after his, obviously, financial settlement around Jeffrey Epstein and Victoria Guthrie and her allegations of sexual assault. And, you know, when you read about him in the British media, Henry, it's starting off to be saying disgraced Prince Andrew. So I don't see any comeback for him. But the problem with Andrew, Henry, is that the Queen, he was always the Queen's favourite.
Prince Harry was her favourite son.
And she, you know, she obviously allowed him to do that very sort of public escorting to the seat, when frankly anybody else would have done would have been Prince Charles or some kind of lady in waiting, any or the Dean, anybody but him. So I think in her latter years, what we are seeing though, Henry, is a gradual fading from public life. She's not appearing very much at all in public. Anything with her now, Platinum Jubilee this year,
yes,
public appearances are going to be very carefully planned. They're going to be very limited, and really, the truth of it is that Prince Charles is actually taking on far more of her workload and her duties. The Queen is in minimum duty.
Sorry to interrupt you. Interesting to note that Harry went to this as well, didn't he?
Harry went to where?
Didn't he go to this?
No, he did not.
He did not.
That raised eyebrows, apparently, again. Other people were disappointed. I suspect William and Charles were less disappointed, as it would have just added to the media circus. He did make a very brief visit to the UK on last week, where he met with the Queen privately briefly. She apparently has kind of sees him as the favourite grandchild, and he came out with that rather frankly pompous statement that he was trying to sort of protect her from other people. Prince Harry has been involved in a long-running row, which he's saying is limiting the time he will spend in England, which is around his security, and an unwilling by the British government and taxpayers to fund especially heavy police protection for Prince Harry, insisting that he must pay for it. And that row, I think it might even be going to court, Henry, is rumbling on.
Okay, now, just before we go, I want to quickly mention, the war in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. It's just hard to watch this stuff on television, I must say. Never mind actually be there. The Americans are doing something about this. Is it Thomas? Are they like going in a bit too late? Should they have been doing this months ago? You know, supplying arms and that kind of thing?
Well, they had been, I think initially they had been flying, probably a few, bringing some in, but now they're flying in tons and tons and tons of weapons, appropriate weapons. So now apparently Ukraine desperately needs field artillery. So they're bringing in the howitzers, and also they're bringing in anti-aircraft. And I think also they're bringing in helicopters. They're giving them helicopters, attack helicopters. But I think the weapons deliveries are all being tailored for the type of weapons Putin's deploying there. And it seems like now he is bringing in mobile artillery on his, and I don't know how much more formidable a vehicle those are on the periphery, but he's trying, but he hasn't yet. He was supposed to be pushing back through Mariupol and supposedly pressing on in the southern part of Ukraine, but these assaults, these efforts have been halted, and I think it's kind of still working up to being a stalemate unless he comes up with more force and some kind of a strategy to get in there and break the back of Ukraine. But it doesn't look like, I'm not going to get too optimistic. I don't want to be too optimistic because I really don't want to jinx Ukraine, because I really want them to win badly.
Yeah, I just think, I feel that they should have done this a lot earlier. Ronan, is Canada helping?
Yes, we are. We're continuing to send armaments and heavy weaponry to Ukraine. I think Thomas is right. A possible scenario here is this grinding on for many months. Clearly, the Russians have, to a large degree, they've certainly been thwarted in their sort of original desire to sort of overthrow, marching into Kiev and overthrowing the Zelensky government. That hasn't happened. It isn't going to happen in the short to medium term. The developments that now are around Moldova being dragged into this, in terms of that southern corridor the Russians are trying to create. We had an outbreak of saber rattling today from Sergei Lavrov, who's the Russian foreign minister, talking about World War III and using nuclear weapons. I think that's just really kind of scaremongering stuff. I think, you know, the Russians don't desire mutually agreed destruction. And the West is right to absolutely arm Ukraine to the teeth here. I think if the Russians are defeated here, we set back their ambitions by decades here. You know, talk of the Ukraine, of the Russians trying to make further threats to other European countries really disappears. The other problem the Russians are having is actually resupplying. They've lost a lot of equipment like tanks and helicopters and even aircraft. Deaths of Russian soldiers are estimated to be potentially up to 20,000. We know that a lot of them are conscripts and not exactly motivated to fight, which is why they've been sort of bringing in mercenaries and people from Syria and that kind of thing.
That's right,
So this could grind on. I think the other fascinating dynamic is what, if anything, will happen to Vladimir Putin. There's another school of thought now emerging based on recent TV pictures. One of him had him gripping a table incredibly tightly in the context that it was keeping him upright. And people looking at his behavior are starting to speculate that he might have Parkinson's.
Who? Putin?
Yes, if he is ill.
Gosh.
I mean, this could be further driving, you know,
his insanity.
Irrational behavior. And
what happens to weak leaders in Russia? There's a kind of a history of that, isn't there?
You know, the kind of phased. And it's not impossible to see a scenario as sanctions bite harder. Now the Russians are obviously striking back on the economic front. They've cut off, or threatening to do so tomorrow, Poland and Bulgaria from gas supplies because they're refusing to pay the Russians in rubles. So this is worrying. Now Germany has done something absolutely unprecedented. They're sending tanks. But they remain terrified, Henry, of the Russians turning off the gas taps.
I know, because they need it so much.
It would cause a recession. There would be rationing.
So it is a big deal, Roland, that they're doing this, because that's not going to make good old Vlad very happy in terms of he might just want to cut that off.
By the way, Sweden and Finland have...
I was about to mention that. That's very interesting, isn't it? Sweden and Finland agree to submit NATO applications. This is going to piss him off even more, isn't it?
You know, I mean, I whatever about Lavrov's rhetoric, the situation is dangerous, and there has to be some sort of the military plan needs to continue in terms of arming. I'm not disputing that, arming the Ukrainians to the teeth and giving them what they need to fight, and the Ukrainians are motivated to fight. But at some point, there has to be some kind of off ramp around this, and the issue is, what is it?
And he's trying, to go without losing face.
Yeah, I mean, it's always come back to, you know, points of principle around Ukraine is sort of permanently neutral. There is potentially, you know, some recognition of these sort of independent Russian states in Ukraine, or some ceding of territory, which the Ukrainians are obviously extremely reluctant to do because they feel it would be rewarding Russia for a completely illegal and unprovoked invasion. So, but at the same time, there has to be an end to this, because a heavy war like this with the type of military engagement we've not seen since World War II cannot continue, with a major global power involved, cannot continue indefinitely without an increasing risk of a miscalculation and something going wrong here in NATO,
and often,
even accidentally becoming engaged.
And often it's mistakes, especially if you started using chemical weapons and that kind of thing.
Now the Russians are sort of threatening arms supplies. I don't think NATO would react to that. You know, this is a breach of Article 5 and we're becoming directly engaged. It's the last thing they want to do. But the miscalculation, a missile hitting Poland, perhaps an error, something happening, as long as there's the risk of something like that happening, it continues somewhat scarily the longer this conflict drags on. I don't believe it's going to go nuclear. There is a possibility that the Russians at least might have contemplated using a battlefield nuclear weapon. I don't believe actually that would provoke a nuclear response from NATO. I think it would provoke other responses. But I think the Russians have made a calculation not to do that.
Well, it's self-destructive if they do it, you know.
Yeah, it is. Lavrov talking about World War III and nuclear war, it's not what the Russians want. It's not what anybody wants. What he's really saying by making those comments is there has to be an end to this that in some way, from the Russians' perspective, recognizes their grievances here, and that they do not want a NATO member right on their border. They do not want missiles placed on their border. How is it achieved in a way that the Russians aren't rewarded for this?
Roland, that's a good point. And I just want to bring back Thomas's point about Sweden and Finland, because you're talking about Russia don't want, you know, NATO on their borders. Well, look what they look what's going to happen.
Country that shares the longest border is Finland. And also Finland has history with Russia. And they're a pretty nice Scandinavian nation. They're, you know, nice people and everything, but I have a feeling if they went to war, they're not
so nice.
The Russians are going to have a repeat of what happened to them in World War II.
It's going to be really interesting to see what happens if Sweden and Finland actually do get into NATO. Okay, we've got to leave it there. Thank you guys so much for joining me and spending so much time.
Sorry it's been so long. Yes, take care of yourself, Henry, and Ronan, take care.
Thank you, Thomas, take care.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. And since we did that interview, it's been reported that Russia has cut off a major supply of natural gas to Poland and Bulgaria. Now, to quote the New York Times, infuriated by the West's supply of arms and other support to help Ukraine resist invading Russian troops, Moscow on Tuesday took the fight to Europe's economy, telling Poland and Bulgaria that it's halting supplies of natural gas, on which both countries and Europe in general are heavily dependent.
Syndicated into Europe from Sydney, Australia, this is Bondi Tunes.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
And we will be back with Bondi Tunes International Hour 2 in 4 minutes' time. Don't go away.
Little town and forget about everything. But The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.